Now let us turn to the United States and its NATO allies' intervention in the Libyan conflict and get a critique from Dr. Stephen Zunis. He is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle East Studies. He serves as a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy and Focus Project of the Institute for Policy Studies. He's an associate editor of Peace Review, a contributing editor of Tikkun, and chair of the Academic Advisory Committee for the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Zunis.
Good to be on.
And yesterday I spoke with Juan Cole, who was arguing against, or at least giving a critique of a part of the left in this country and in Europe as well, that opposes the U.S. and NATO intervention in Libya. And, of course, I wanted to get another critique. So just in brief, what is your fundamental argument against this intervention?
Well, what it comes down to, I think, is that this is not a humanitarian intervention. This is not... We're not doing this to prevent a massacre. I am not opposed in principle to the idea of the responsibility to protect. I don't think that national sovereignty should protect a tyrant if they're engaged in genocide or mass slaughter or that kind of thing. But I really have not seen clear evidence that this was transpiring or about to transpire. I mean, there's certainly war crimes, but... going on, but no worse than the kinds of things that have been committed by some of America's closest allies in recent decades. But rather, the issue here is whether the United States should be taking sides in a civil war. And I'm dubious, despite the fact my sympathies are definitely with pro-democracy forces in Libya. I definitely would love to see Gaddafi gone, as do most people. But the whenever the United States and the Western powers gets involved in the internal conflicts in a Middle Eastern country, we found it it's been a lot more complicated than many people suspect. And the other problem, I think, is that, I think the movement in Libya initially started out as sincere and broad-based and legitimate as the pro-democracy struggles we've seen in Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, Bahrain, Syria, you know, any number of other countries, that as it has become primarily an armed struggle, some pretty sketchy characters have risen to the top, including people who were in Gaddafi's cabinet until a few weeks ago, including one fellow who's worked closely with the CIA for quite a few years, including some radical Islamists, people whose commitment to democracy is rather questionable. And finally, my big concern is that one of the remarkable things that we've seen in these pro-democracy uprisings elsewhere is that they were genuinely indigenous and popular movements. This was not, despite accusations by the dictators of one thing or another, these were not inspired by foreigners. These were not about somebody else's agenda. These were legitimate struggles for freedom. And whereas this does seem a little more like an old-fashioned foreign intervention for a particular faction, that is frankly not being as successful. Because here's the other thing that's really important, is that the Libyan movement was doing better when they were nonviolent. That's when they liberated most of the country. That's when you had all these high-ranking defections from Gaddafi's inner circle, from the military, foreign ambassadors, even mistresses. I mean, all people were, it looked like his days were numbered. But when they went to armed struggle, they challenged Gaddafi on his strongest point. And one of the paradoxes that people don't realize, and empirically this shows the case, that even when you're battling brutal dictators, nonviolent action tends to be at least twice as effective as armed struggle in terms of defeating the regime in question, because you're able to mobilize a larger sector of the population. Defections from security forces are far more higher if they're being ordered to fire into unarmed demonstrators than if they're being shot at. The foreign intervention has brought in the whole nationalist card, and you know, Libyans are traditionally quite xenophobic. That's played into Gaddafi's hands. So just even putting aside some of the legal and moral and ideological questions, purely on a pragmatic level, armed struggle, especially with foreign intervention, seems less effective if the goal indeed is to get rid of Gaddafi.
Well, Stephen Zunis, let's start with that point, because I did recently speak with Gene Scott, who is the intellectual godfather of all of these nonviolent struggles, particularly the Egyptian one, and starting with Otpor in Serbia, and all of these young revolutionaries the various Arab revolutions have in fact been inspired by Gene Scott. But Gene Sharp. Yep. Yes, what am I talking about? Gene Sharp. When you say though that the nonviolent revolutionaries who took over most of Libya then went to armed struggle, my recollection of what happened was they took over the place. The Gaddafi and the sons were sort of keeping their powder dry, and they warned them, and they said, we're going to just crush you like cockroaches. And when they decided to crush them like cockroaches, a professional army routed these nonviolent protesters and drove them all the way back to Benghazi very quickly.
No, they did not drive them back anywhere. Many tragically were killed, and many were arrested. But this is not like a standing army where people will advance and retreat, you know, quite the same way. Often when people think of nonviolent action, they think of these, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands or whatever, people massing in a central square and whatever. And in some cases that can be effective. But just like in guerrilla warfare, there are times for frontal attacks, there are times for, you know, so-called final offensives or whatever, and there's time for tactical retreat, there's time for diversification of tactics, there's time, one needs to think strategically. And that was the problem with the nonviolent struggle in Libya. It was not that it was nonviolent, it was that they didn't think strategically. We've seen in Tiananmen Square being one of the most well-known cases of a nonviolent movement that clearly overplayed their hand and did not have the strategic and tactical innovation to deal with what they were dealing with.
But how do you deal with tanks and armies with loaded guns?
Remember, hundreds of people were killed in Tunisia and in Egypt. Thousands were killed in nonviolent struggles in other countries.
I saw the guy with the Chinese guy with the briefcase standing in front of the tank. That was inspiring. But they also, I saw the bodies of hundreds of these young kids.
Oh, yeah. Again, they made a tactical mistake of all massing in the central place and essentially calling for the abolition of the whole system before they made alliance with the workers to go on strike, for general strikes, before diversifying their tactics for a longer-term struggle. And this is the equivalent of a guerrilla army calling for the a final offensive before they have built up their base in the liberated zones and et cetera. Again, it comes down to strategic and tactical questions.
But doesn't it also have a lot to do with who you're up against? I mean, you could make the argument, surely, Stephen Zunis, that what's common throughout all these uprisings in the so-called Arab Spring are that these young Arabs throughout the Middle East are aspiring for a better life and more opportunity and more democracy. They have all that in common. They're very tech-savvy, and they're very up on what's happening in the world. The difference is the extent to which the people they're up against, the dictatorships they're up against, are prepared to be ruthless. And my question to you is, surely Gaddafi and his sons, there's no limit to their ruthlessness.
That's true with a lot of tyrants. I remember Marcos and Milosevic and even Ben Ali, it's now on record, specifically ordered his troops to massacre protesters by the thousands, and they refused. And in some cases, like in Mali, the uprising against Traore in 1991, the military did initially shoot into crowds, killing many hundreds. People kept coming back, and eventually the army mutinied because they couldn't do that anymore. There's too much dissent within the ranks. The reason that Tahrir Square did not turn into Tiananmen Square was not because Mubarak was a nice guy, but because it was pretty clear that they rank and file soldiers and not obey. I mean, look at Suharto in Indonesia. This guy has more blood in his hands than virtually any late 20th century dictator outside the Khmer Rouge. Yet he was overthrown, a largely unarmed insurrection, simply because, again, you couldn't trust the loyalty of his forces. So it's not a matter that Gaddafi is more ruthless than the others, because we've seen a nonviolent action work even against ruthless regimes. And indeed, there is this effect that Gene Sharp refers to as political jujitsu. I think probably Aikido would be a better analogy. But when the force of the regime is used against them, when they do take up that kind of force, so there are any number of complex reasons why a given struggle doesn't succeed or succeeds. But I don't think the simply the ruthlessness of the regime is necessarily the key variable here.
Well, it seems to have been the deciding facts on the ground in terms of driving the revolution all the way back from Tripoli, all the way back to Benghazi.
That part took place after they took up arms.
I understand, but there's never been any symmetry. All you have to do is look at the pictures of these kids in jeans and sneakers and T-shirts, with some gun they found somewhere up against.
That's why I'm saying, yeah, I'm not making a moral judgment against people who do that. I wouldn't make moral judgment against any people and oppressed people who feel a need to take up arms. I'm not a pacifist. This is not a value judgment here. This is just in terms of tactically and strategically. When you don't have an armed, well-trained armed force, you're going to be in bigger trouble than if you can take advantage of your numbers, through massive non-cooperation and other forms of resistance. Which again,
would that have worked though? When NATO intervened, Gaddafi was on the doorstep of Benghazi, and he and his sons said that they were going to get retribution. And you say at that point, had they not resorted to armed struggle, there'd be no civil war. The other argument would be that there'd be no more rebellion. Yeah, sure, the civil war would be over. That's because he would have wiped them all out.
Yeah, and it's possible. I'm not opposed to this idea of a humanitarian intervention in principle. But again, we've seen this is not what it's about right now. For example, Gaddafi has now agreed to a ceasefire. Now, if I was a rebel, I would accept the ceasefire. I would consolidate the control of the liberated areas, should have a model of good governance, and start strategizing for massive non-cooperation, general strikes, and other ways to undermine Gaddafi's power in the remaining areas. But since they feel, NATO's got our back, we can keep on fighting. Now, if this is truly simply a matter of responsibility to protect or humanitarian intervention, and why isn't NATO encouraging the rebels to accept the ceasefire instead of keep on fighting? Clearly more people are going to get killed on both sides.
Well, I'm pretty convinced that this whole NATO exercise has little to do with its stated aims. This was the best deal that they could get, given the reluctance of the Arab League and the opposition of the African Union. So the subtext is to get rid of Gaddafi. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And frankly, just as in terms of a strategic analysis of it, nothing they're doing makes any sense, unless you do get rid of Gaddafi and his sons. Otherwise, that explains the inconsistency to me. It's just that nobody, including Obama, is prepared to speak truth to that. But both you and I were big supporters of the Sandinistas back in Nicaragua in the 80s, and of course against the hideous murderous government in El Salvador that the Reagan administration supported. And I'm just trying to make analogies now between the idea of the Sandinistas People Army that we were so enamored with, fighting against a dictator that we found so abhorrent. Why aren't we enamored with these this manifestly clear citizens' army up against an even more ruthless dictator with tremendous amounts of money, more than Somoza could ever dream of, hiring Belarusian mercenaries. One of the sons now has his entire army is an army of mercenaries.
I would love to see Gaddafi overthrown. My concerns again are, one is that even though it is indeed a popular revolution, I'm less enamored with some of the people in the leadership. I mean, I think the resistance by the Afghan Mujahideen to the Soviet invasion occupation was legit in principle, but 80% of the arms the U.S. sent to the Mujahideen ended up in the hands of the Hakmakhtiar group, which is an extreme fundamentalist, misogynist, these guys are allied with the Taliban now. Unlike nonviolent struggle, where by its very nature you need to build broad alliances, broad coalitions, it brings about the better elements of civil society and pluralism. In armed struggle, you get this elite vanguard. With these martial values, which is much more likely to turn into another dictatorship or end up fighting among themselves. The Sandinistas certainly had their factions, but they were pretty relatively unified group compared to this motley assortment that's in Libya. And my fear is, with going to the armed struggle and with U.S. intervention, it is not leading to the rise of the more legitimate democratic elements, but rather just the opposite.
But Stephen Zunis, the Sandinistas were supported by the Cubans and by the Soviets.
No, that's fine. But there's the limited amount of small arms that went to them was nothing close to the massive air power that is coming in from NATO. There was not any direct intervention by Soviets or Cubans.
But of course, at this point, there's a lot of military analysts suggest that, in spite of NATO's firepower, they're not going anywhere. This could be fought to a standstill because
exactly, and that of course has its its. Own very issues of concern, potential partition of the country, and all sorts of other things. And again, that's why I believe that they'd be more successful if they accepted the ceasefire and returned to a primarily nonviolent strategy, which could be a protracted struggle as well, but not nearly as fraught with the dangers I fear in foreign intervention and war.
Well, I guess the two scenarios then, just in wrapping up here, Stephen Zunis, is that one, they would have been wiped out and Gaddafi would have presided over a victory, and then eventually there'd be some revolution against him. Now there's a revolution that almost succeeded but was turned back by his superior firepower. And you're suggesting now that they've fought to a draw, they ought to just take the best deal they can make.
But don't stop there. That's when you re-escalate the nonviolent struggle, and then again form a genuinely democratic model in the liberated parts of the country that the rest of Libya will want to emulate.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Stephen Zunis.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Zunis, who's a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle Eastern studies. Let's do a wrap-up on today's program. We began with Randall Ray, who just returned from the Bretton Woods Conference over the weekend. That's been funded by George Soros. Of course, Glenn Beck made all kinds of hysterical announcements about this coven of anti-sovereign Bilderberger types, backroom people who are going to destroy the very essence of American freedom and sell us to some international consortium of bankers led by George Soros. In fact, it really is a kind of an irrelevant debating society of smart economists, but their word's not getting out. And that extends to the general problem that the Democrats are completely absent. If the Republicans have stolen the narrative, they're dominating the discourse, they're driving the politics behind this deficit hoax. None of it makes any sense. You don't cut money from a sick economy. It makes no economic sense. But there's no pushback. There's no arguments from the Democrats. And Randall Ray was a pretty grim analysis. And we even went into the extent to which the commodity prices are gouging the average American for food and gasoline. That's all a part of the same people on Wall Street that we rescued. Now they're screwing us with this speculative bubble, which is entirely unproductive. One of the points that he made was that the reason it's unproductive is, frankly, there's nowhere else for the rich to put their money except to inflate the stock market. There's no, the real estate market's gone south. So there's clearly some need to have a rational economy and not one that's controlled by the super rich and the super greedy. That became also the theme of the second guest, Scott Klinger, the co-author of a report from the Institute of Policy Studies called Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Shutdown. He suggested that reversing the tax giveaways for the super rich could erase the debt and end the deficits in a matter of 10 years, and then laid out some of the really shocking statistics about how little corporations pay in tax. The difference from 1961 to the present, where back in 1961, millionaires paid 43.1% of their income in taxes. Now, in this year, 2011, they pay 23.1. So they've almost down by a half. And corporations back in 1961 paid 47.4% of their profits in tax. Now it's down to 11.1. Welcome to the oligarchy. And it was really a shocking revelation. And again, we also, with him, addressed the issues of commodity prices and pointing out that in so many ways, other countries, European countries, have changed the rules to discourage speculation by a speculative tax, so you don't have these people churning over trades for the sake of trading, like these high-speed computer trading that Goldman Sachs is making a ton of money at by literally moving their computer right next to the stock exchange to get that millisecond of speed of light advantage. But they don't make any productive contribution to the overall economy. He also suggested there should be a tax on anybody but end users in the commodities market. In other words, oil refineries, airlines who need gasoline and need have a stable supply should be able to invest in the mercantile exchange and buy future contracts, but not people who are essentially, ironically, of course, it's pension funds that are driving up. That's the money that's driving up the price of gasoline. So the rich Americans are screwing poor Americans. It's that simple. And then finally, we had a debate with Stephen Zunis, who, following Juan Cole's critique of leftist opponents to intervention in Libya today, we had a anti-interventionist giving his argument, which he put forth, that the Libyan opposition should not have resorted to armed struggle. I'm not sure that they had any choice. He said that once they took up armed struggle, they lost the civil war. Arguably, had they not been rescued by NATO as they were being driven back, and Gaddafi said he would crush them like insects and rats, there would have been no more armed struggle. That's one way of ending it, with a victory for Gaddafi. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. If you've heard something you like, something you don't like, any suggestions or tip, let us know. We read every email. You can also check out my blog. Go to ianmasters.com and click on blog. Bye for now.